dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1. Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Idaho, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, California, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On the program tonight, the human costs of the Iraq War 2 years on. George Sapio and Maura Stevens tell about their visits to Iraq and give an overview of the situation there.
I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed. So take your peace.
Sister Diana Ortiz is an American nun who was tortured by the Guatemalan military in 1989. She's testified that the torture sessions were overseen by American operatives. She is now the director of Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition International. Here's what she wrote in an article published last week. Good Friday brings Christians once again to the darkest day of the year, the torture and death of Jesus. For those of us who are both Christians and survivors of torture, Good Friday has an additional meaning. It is but one more reminder that for the tortured, every day is Good Friday, in the sense that during every day of the year, there are those who hang on one government's cross or another, tortured as was Jesus 2,000 years ago. From that day to this, governments that torture have justified what they do, saying, "What we have done is only what we had to do," rather than calling it torture. We are assured that what is done, whatever it is, quote, "for the protection of the state, the protection of you, the people." If questioned closely, we are assured that there is no blood on our hands. If there is blood, that is, if it cannot be denied that blood has been spilled, then it is not the leaders who spilled it, but only those on the lowest levels from whom such barbaric acts may be expected. So it has been for a long time, and so it is today. Our leaders attempt to keep secret what they do. When they are caught, they claim that what they do is not what they do. That is, they lie. When they cannot deny what was done, they blame others, those far from them, hillbillies and bad apples, intentionally using code words to imply, "They are not like us. What can you expect from those with no culture?" It is as if what happened on that Friday so long ago was caused by a few Roman bad apples, low-level soldiers standing around the cross, acting on their own to produce that death agony taking place there. In this, the holiest time in the Christian calendar, what might we ask our leaders? What might we ask that, although they will not give it, is within their power to give? In the spirit of Easter, we might at least hope for a resurrection of truth from President George W. Bush and those who work for him. Instead, what we hear is something like, "Renditions occur, it is true, and indeed to countries that torture. But we make sure to ask them if they intend to torture this particular person, and they say no, of course not, and we, of course, believe them." We are asked to accept this type of statement as truth. Donald Rumsfeld certifies procedures which are plain and simple torture, not abuse. Yet he meant them to be used only in Guantanamo, not in Iraq, for heaven's sake. He's not responsible for what happened there. It's those bad apples. All agree they must be punished, and they are. No blood on Rumsfeld's hands. Apparently, while he was White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez decided nothing, influenced nothing. He just passed on memos from the Justice Department to the president. No blood on his hands. And the president himself? He states to the world that the U.S. position on torture is never to anyone, anywhere, anytime, for any reason. Yet he had signed the rendition order long before he made that statement on June 26, 2003. No blood on his hands. If the Bush administration won't stop torturing, and apparently they won't, will they not at least stand up and tell the truth? The de facto policy of the Bush administration is to torture. Own up to it. Tell the truth. That indeed would be an Easter miracle. Sister Diana Ortiz, torture survivor, director of the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Coalition International.
Ba 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 we're lambs. 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 Ba 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 we're lambs.
I'd like to welcome a very special guest now. From the original Ray's Original Roman Pizza, Ray.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, Ray. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Ray, as an ancient Roman, we're really interested in your perspective on this. Some people compare America, in terms of its power and wealth, as being unprecedented in world history, except for the Roman Empire. Do you see any comparisons between the American Empire and the Roman Empire?
There's no comparison. The Roman Empire, by far, was much more exciting and vibrant a place to live in. It was a fabulous place, with gold-encrusted buildings. It was wonderful. Today, what do we have? Except for this beautiful pizzeria, located on Christopher Street. This fabulous place, everything else, nothing.
Well, there's New York City, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Chicago. These are great cities with lots of culture. And
Don't get me wrong. They're very nice. But the ancient Rome, what?
More marble.
We're talking classic. Okay?
Moving on to some other contemporary issues. In the movies this week is The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's new film. Stirring a lot of controversy. Have you gotten a chance to get out and see it yet?
You know, I had the real thing. I remember on the Appian Way, we used to have them lined up into the sunset. It was wonderful. I mean, impressive. What do I want to go see a movie with three guys getting crucified for? I mean, who was it? This Jesus Christ, the Jewish fellow.
Sure, he was the Jewish.
What did he do?
Well, he led people in, I guess you could say, a spiritual revolt.
Oh, a rebellious kid. Yeah, well, you know, that'll happen to you. But, I mean, I don't understand the blood. We used to tie him up there, leave him, go home, have a good lunch, take a nap, come back and watch till sunset. And they died, believe me. We didn't have to beat him up or cut him or make him bleed. It was none of that mess. It was very picturesque the way we did it.
There are critics still of The Passion of the Christ who say that it's inflaming anti-Semitism, which some fear is on the rise all around the world.
I don't understand.
Okay.
Jesus is a Jewish fellow, right?
Yes.
Well, now how does beating up a Jewish fellow inflame anti-Semitism? I mean, you know, don't people feel sorry for this poor guy?
Well, I think...
God, I know I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why do they say it's inflame anti-Semitism?
Well, I think the whole idea of what Christ was doing was to invoke compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still those who blame the Jews, being the Jewish priests, who sent him off to be executed by the Romans for his execution.
So they're saying the Jewish priests were behind all of this?
That seems to be how it's depicted in the
film. What, the poor innocent Roman soldiers, they were, you know, they were just doing what the Jewish priests said, right? Yeah, come on, get out of here.
You don't believe
that? No, look, the Romans that I know didn't need encouragement to crucify anybody. They were out there working at it every day. They didn't need to be encouraged by Jewish priests. They were dedicated.
Mora Stevens began her career in journalism at the New York City headquarters of Newsweek magazine, starting as a researcher and working her way up through the ranks from researcher to general editor for the international editions. She left Newsweek after 19 years and has since written on a wide variety of topics for other publications and worked in higher education. Stevens' training and experience in journalism led her to question the reliability of mainstream media reports about Iraq. In January 2003, just weeks before the invasion, she and her husband, photographer George Sapio, joined a humanitarian mission to that country. They found out firsthand how ordinary Iraqi people, particularly women and children, had been affected by years of living under a politically repressive regime, United Nations sanctions, and devastating wars. Upon their return, they published a book of photographs and text entitled Collateral Damage, in hopes of showing Americans a glimpse of life for the ordinary people of Iraq. The couple returned to Iraq in June and July of 2003 to document how the Iraqi people had fared during and after the invasion. Since their first trip, Mora Stevens has spent countless hours researching issues on Iraq and has become recognized as an expert on the area. She has given talks around the country as a member of the National Iraq Speakers Bureau at colleges and universities, schools, civic groups, and churches and temples. She's also a vice president of Theocracy Watch, a project of the Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy at Cornell University, and a member of the National Theocracy Watch Speakers Bureau. She works closely with EPIC, the Education for Peace in Iraq Center, on policy issues, and with Life for Relief and Development to bring humanitarian aid to the people of Iraq. The presentation we're about to hear was taped on March 19th in Ithaca, New York. Stephen's talk was accompanied by beautiful and devastating photos by her husband George Sapio, which unfortunately cannot be seen on the radio. Mora Stevens.
I wonder if any of you can identify Iraq on this map of the Middle East. If you didn't get it right, don't feel too bad about it. A National Geographic survey recently, actually taken shortly before the invasion, showed that 87% of 18 to 24-year-old Americans couldn't find Iraq on a map. 70% could not find New Jersey. 49% could not find New York. And an unbelievable 11% could not even find the United States. So let's go back to our map. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of Iraq's ancient history. As you probably remember from grammar school history classes, the Fertile Crescent, or Mesopotamia, the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, is where the first civilization started some 7,000 years ago. This is present-day Iraq. The Tigris flows through Baghdad. It's the river across which you saw the shock and the awe on CNN and Fox News during the invasion. This is where farming was developed, and irrigation, canals, and ditches. The dog was domesticated in the region. Here, Sumerians developed cuneiform writing some 5,000 years ago, and mathematics, and the wheel, pottery, the arts, theology, and our very concept of time. About 1800 BCE, the first laws were written here, the Code of Hammurabi, who was the founder of the Babylonian Empire. The world's first city, Uruk, was built in Mesopotamia. Architecture, astronomy, physics, medicine, and education were developed here. We visited the ancient city of Babylon just before the invasion. It's an astonishing place. It's got miles and miles of city, including dwellings, temples, palaces, farmland, and a huge maze in which we spent some time getting lost. Now, this was built circa 580 BCE under King Nebuchadnezzar, and restored during the 1980s by Saddam Hussein's Ministry of Antiquities, even while the country was waging war on Iran. It's the kind of place that should be visited by scholars and tourists often, you would think, but we were among only a few visitors who had even been there in a very long time. Visitors, especially Westerners, stopped coming here about 20 years ago. The country has been isolated on many fronts, and its ancient culture largely forgotten, except by some historians and archaeologists and artists, which is a little strange because museums in Europe and the United States are packed with cultural booty brought back from Mesopotamia in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Mustan Sariya University in Baghdad is almost certainly the first university ever built in the world. It was built in AD 1233. Now, this is where education as we know it now was developed. Before this, study had been done in private homes and mosques. But this was the first time students could come to one place to learn all the subjects. When we visited in February 2003, it had recently received major renovations. The people who run the place were just delighted to have us visit and told us we were the first visitors they had welcomed in 6 months. On March 23rd, 2003, the university was hit by US bombs following airstrikes in Baghdad. We also visited the Iraqi National Women's Museum, where the women showed us beautiful ancient Sumerian, Assyrian, and Babylonian treasures. Now here in Ithaca, we live not too far from Seneca Falls, home of the US National Women's Hall of Fame. How many of you have been there? Pretty good, not everybody, but that's pretty good. That's more hands than I usually see. Now that place is pretty splendid and we're proud of it, but it only includes a few hundred years of women's history and historical artifacts and information. In Iraq, its counterpart houses thousands of years of items and history. But sadly, when we returned to Iraq in June, the museum was completely shuttered with scores of bullet holes in the outside. Like many buildings that we saw there, it had been emptied during the lootings following the invasion as well. There are hundreds of thousands of precious archaeological and historical treasures in museums around the country, and up to 100,000 archaeological sites. Iraqis are very proud of their ancient culture, and they take very seriously their culture's role as historian of civilization, because the history of Iraq really is the history of the world. That's one of the reasons that on March 26, 2003, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, which was headed by Jay Garner, you may remember him, before the creation of the Coalition Provisional Authority. Well, his office made sure to give the Department of Defense a list of 16 institutions that merit securing as soon as possible to prevent further damage, destruction, and or pilferage of records and assets. First on the list was the National Bank. Next came the National Museum. McGuire Gibson, a University of Chicago archaeology professor who was one of the world's leading scholars on Mesopotamia, warned the Pentagon before the invasion that there was a high risk of looting at the Iraqi National Museum. Other sites that the ORHA placed on the list were the Ministries of Education, Health, Agriculture, Industry, and Irrigation. The Oil Ministry was 16th on this list of 16. Oh, by the way, the U.S. observes the Hague Convention of 1954, which prohibits the targeting of cultural and religious sites in war. But of those 16 institutions, only one was carefully protected by U.S. troops. The Oil Ministry. And only it managed to avoid being looted and ransacked on Friday, April 11th. This is something that came out on April 21st from CBS. It said the ORHA is to coordinate delivery of outside assistance to the 24 million Iraqis, oversee rebuilding of the nation's infrastructure, which have been in disrepair after a decade of UN sanctions, neglect by Saddam's regime, and 3 weeks of US bombing, and oversee the establishment of an interim Iraqi government. For ordinary Iraqis, however, the first needs are for water and electricity, knocked out during the war, and especially for security in a city racked by almost 2 weeks of looting. At the city's major electrical plant, Major Andy Backus of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers told Garner that workers had managed to restore power to only 1% of the city. But hopefully this evening, we will have the lights on in 10% of Baghdad. Electrical power is key to the proper functioning of other important civilian utilities, like water and sanitation. Even Ahmed Shalabi has described Garner's job of one of getting Iraq's infrastructure and services back in shape in a few weeks, after which time Iraqis would take over and the Americans would be limited. That was April 21st, 2003. The telecommunications and electricity were out in most of the country during that time, as they still are, now 24 months after the invasion and 22 months after George W. Bush declared an end to the major hostilities. There were no cell phones in all of Iraq. But by some bizarre chance that will never be documented, throughout the country on that day, April 11th, universities, libraries, museums, schools, and even mosques and community centers were ransacked by hordes of looters. Nobody can say for sure who they were. Among the places looted that day, 2 days after the declared fall of Baghdad, was the University of Mosul, about the size of Cornell University. It was completely decimated. Everything down to the switch plates on the walls was taken and the light bulbs. This young professor of English shared a teensy office and an ancient computer with two other professors. The few books they had, their office telephone, and their personal things, including her only copy of her wedding photo, she had just been married a few months before, were taken. That was April 11th. When we visited on the 4th of July, they still hadn't recovered a thing, and they hadn't received one scrap of paper's worth of assistance from the coalition authority. Somehow, though, they managed to finish out the school year and graduate the students just by sheer willpower. We have kept in touch with the dean, Basil Al-Azawi, but we lost track of him in October. We completely lost contact with him. We're quite sick with worry about him and all the other people that we've come to care so much about. The Iraqi people have been through an awful lot this last century. The actual country of Iraq, with its present boundaries, was formed in 1921 by the winners of World War I after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, basically as a British puppet government. Oil had been found in several areas, including the northern city of Kirkuk. The Turkish Petroleum Company, which was owned largely by the British Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which became British Petroleum and then BP, was getting thirstier as cars became more widely available in the United States and Europe. I'll skip ahead to the coup that brought Saddam Hussein to power in 1979. His rise was in large part a reaction to the fundamentalist Islamic uprising in Iran, in which the Shah was overthrown and Ayatollah Khomeini took over. Now, Saddam was a Sunni Muslim, but he very much wanted a secular state. He hated the fundamentalists then, just as he hated Osama bin Laden 2 years ago, and probably still hates him today. Now, you've all heard about how terrible Saddam was. The US government even issued a bizarre deck of cards listing the 54 most wanted people from his regime, and he was the top card, the ace of spades. And he was indeed a terrible man. Nobody would disagree with that. But one thing we find that most Americans don't know is that despite the political repression under his rule, there were economic prosperity and social progressiveness. For example, health care and education, all the way through the doctoral degree, were free, universal, and public. That is, they were paid for by the government. Most women attended universities, and many worked in various professions. By Middle Eastern standards, they were quite liberated. Literacy was very high. Nearly all urban dwellers and more than 70% of rural residents had access to clean water, while nearly 95% of Iraqis had access to the very advanced health care. Iraqi social services were among the most generous and comprehensive in the region, and Iraq had a good agricultural base. The country had among the highest per capita access to food in the Middle East. It also had one of the lowest child mortality rates in the world. The worst childhood health problem was obesity. The United Nations termed Iraq a verge first world country. All in all, it was a relatively comfortable middle class life for most people, as long as they kept out of politics and voiced no dissent. But that doesn't cover everybody, of course. In September 1980, a little more than a year after he took power, Saddam Hussein invaded his much bigger neighbor, Iran, which had been taken over by fundamentalist Muslim Ayatollah Khomeini the year before. During the war, Iraq was quietly supported by the United States, although publicly the U.S. claimed to be neutral. Most of the chemical, biological, and conventional weapons Saddam Hussein's army used during that time were supplied by the United States and other Western nations. Now, this included the nerve gases and chemicals Saddam used against Iranians during the war and against Kurds in his own country in 1988. Congressional records and documents from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have shown that the CDC and a biological company called American Type Culture Collection sent strains of germs, including anthrax, the bacteria used to make botulinum toxin, the germs that cause gangrene and other deadly pathogens, including the West Nile virus, directly to Iraqi sites that were part of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program. The transfer of these biological agents, which happened during the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq, were detailed in a 1994 Senate Banking Committee report and a 1995 follow-up from the CDC to the Senate. The exports were legal at the time. Iraq was considered a good guy then. The Iran-Iraq War ended up lasting 8 years and killing about 200,000 people on each side. Almost every Iraqi person we spoke to said that a member of his or her family had been killed, lost, or wounded during that war, which ended up being more or less a draw. There was a brief lull then without war for the Iraqi people as they tried to enjoy family life and get back to normal. But the long war had done some $200 billion worth of damage to Iraq's infrastructure, and the country was in trouble financially. There weren't enough jobs to go around for the 200,000 soldiers who had returned from the war. The U.S. and Britain were increasing food aid to their Iraqi friend Saddam Hussein, but things were getting tight, and Hussein was having border disputes with his tiny but very rich southern neighbor, Kuwait, which controlled access to the Persian Gulf and which also wanted repayment of the $12 to $14 billion it had loaned Saddam during the war. Iraq's oil income was limited by OPEC quotas. At the same time, Kuwait and United Arab Emirates were exceeding their OPEC quota, depressing petroleum prices and restricting Iraq's income further. So Saddam Hussein and his administration decided to invade Kuwait, which they did on August 2nd, 1990. The UN Security Council made a resolution condemning the invasion and another imposing mandatory sanctions and embargo on Iraq. Saddam offered a peace proposal that involved the withdrawal of Israel from the occupied Arab territories. That was rejected by the United States and Kuwait. So the Security Council passed another resolution, number 678, authorizing all necessary means to restore international peace and security in the area unless Iraq agreed to a ceasefire and an unconditional withdrawal of its troops from Kuwait by January 15, 1991. That time the U.S. Congress was divided between keeping pressure via sanctions and going to war, but ultimately both houses authorized President George H.W. Bush, the father of the current Bush, to use military force. Iraq's parliament unanimously decided to go to war rather than leave Kuwait. American-led Operation Desert Storm, the air campaign, started on January 16th. Among its primary targets were civilian infrastructure, such as electrical grids, water treatment plants, sewage plants, and telecommunications facilities. In their 110,000 air sorties, coalition forces dropped on Iraqi targets between 100,000 and 140,000 tons of explosives, equivalent to 5 to 7 of the nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima during World War II. Now, I'm going to warn you, some of the photographs coming up are rather hard to watch. More than 1 million rounds of weapons carrying depleted uranium, or DU, were used against Iraqis, both troops and civilians, in the Gulf War. Depleted uranium was also incorporated into tank armor, missile and aircraft counterweights and navigational devices, and in tank, air, anti-aircraft and anti-personnel artillery. Now, DU is radioactive waste from uranium-238 and its daughters, mainly thorium-234 and protactinium-234. It is radiologically and chemically toxic to humans and other forms of life. It has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Some 320 to 350 tons of it was fired during the Gulf War. Upon impact, between 60% and 80% of DU becomes minute particles that can enter the body via inhalation, ingestion, or an open sore or wound. If a person inhales or ingests DU dust, it enters into the bloodstream. Prolonged exposure to radiation may cause problems such as cancers, mainly leukemia and lung and bone cancers, pulmonary and lymph node fibrosis, pneumoconiosis, inhibition of reproductive activities, chromosomal changes, depletion of the body's immune system, and death. It can be transmitted from the father, and it can pass through the placenta into a child. Besides the civilians exposed, more than 400,000 U.S. military veterans were exposed to DU dust, to the tune of more than 300 tons during the 1991 Gulf War. Much of this DU contained trace elements of plutonium, the most toxic chemical known to humankind. The Veterans Administration cites more than 160,000 Gulf War veterans on disability status whose condition may be related to DU. Numerous groups are working to help these veterans. There are many lawsuits pending as well. More than 15,000 U.S. veterans of the Gulf War have died in the 14 years since it ended. These U.S. veterans were exposed not only to depleted uranium, but also to various other extremely hazardous chemical and biological substances. Three vaccines were administered to those who served in Iraq, intended to protect them against nerve and biological warfare agents. They were, and forgive me, scientists, if I don't pronounce these things quite right, but pyridostigmine, which is normally prescribed for myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disorder. This is known to have serious side effects, especially when the person taking it is exposed to heat. Botulinum pentavalent, an unproven vaccine intended to counteract botulism. It was unlicensed in the United States at the time. And anthrax to protect against the disease anthrax. This was apparently selectively administered to troops during the war, and women receiving it were warned not to have children for 3 to 4 years. Besides this, tremendous amounts of smoke and chemical pollutants were released by the continuous oil well fires. Levels of soot, carbon monoxide, and ozone have been studied by an EPA task force. That's the Environmental Protection Agency, forgive me. The National Toxics Campaign found 5 different toxic hydrocarbon products in the smoke released by the continuous oil well fires, any one of which can induce serious health effects, especially in youngsters. Destruction by allies of Iraqi chemical, nerve, and biological warfare weapons resulted in widespread distribution of these toxins in the environment. Veterans were also exposed to a broad spectrum of electromagnetic radiation created in support of their high-tech instruments. And the U.S. used pesticides and insecticides extensively throughout the war. Large quantities of DDT, malathion, phenytoin, proxapur, deltamethrin, and permethrin, all toxic nerve agents and suspected carcinogens, many of them outlawed in this country. Anyway, in just weeks, the U.S.-led coalition power proved too much for Iraq's overextended army. By February 26th, Iraqi troops had withdrawn from Kuwait and were making their way back home. Many of them were slaughtered by coalition forces while they retreated. Iraqi fatalities totaled about 60,000. The United States sustained 266, including 125 due to accidents during pre-war field training. Right after the ceasefire, Shia Muslims in the south of the country, bolstered by promises of United States help, rose up in rebellion against Saddam Hussein. Saddam called his army back into service and quelled the uprising very quickly, with a total death toll of about 30,000. Another 70,000 to 80,000 fled to Iran. There wasn't a peep from the United States or other countries to help these rebels. At the same time, some 100,000 Kurdish rebels up north, they were actually members of the Iraqi army, they changed sides and took over a series of northern cities. They were put down too, but with much less bloodshed because the Bush 1 administration stepped in to help the Kurds when the public outcry became too loud. Sanctions were eased briefly, but were soon stepped up to pressure Saddam Hussein to give up his weapons of mass destruction, weapons which he certainly wanted, but after more than a decade of war, he wasn't really in a position to come by too easily. The sanctions were kept in place until after the beginning of the recent U.S. occupation, despite an international humanitarian outcry. These sanctions kept out a lot of things. They kept out automobiles and trucks and heavy equipment and parts to repair them, and parts to repair water and waste treatment plants and electrical grids and telecommunication lines. They kept out medicines and lung machines, even dental care items and morphine that would allow the terminally ill to die with dignity and a minimum of suffering. They either completely prohibited medicines or didn't allow them to reach the places in the country where they were needed, such as hospitals and clinics, before their expiration dates. And that especially went for the chemicals used in chemotherapies and the radium used in radiation treatment for cancer patients. The sanctions kept out firefighting equipment and wheelbarrows. They kept out air-conditioned trucks and the parts to repair them. So many medicines that require refrigeration are useless in the intense summer temperatures, which when we were there were between 125 and 135 degrees. The sanctions also kept out chlorine, which is used to purify water, because chlorine could be used to make chlorine gas, a weapon of mass destruction. And most types of cleaning detergent were banned under sanctions. At the hospitals we visited, amazingly, they used gasoline, the only solvent available to them, to scrub the floors and surfaces. The reek of it was absolutely overwhelming. But we got used to it after a while, just as I suppose the doctors and nurses and patients do. Under sanctions, the little medicine that did make it into the country was almost always seized by members of the Ba'athist regime, either for use by members of their own family or for sale on the black market. The sanctions also kept out books, papers, journals, educational materials, violin strings, and lead pencils. They kept out all sorts of consumer goods. The list is long and startling. The teachers and professors in Iraq have received no new outside knowledge, essentially, since 1990. Which might not seem so bad when you think of philosophy or religion or languages, but think of medicine and technology and science and the incredible leaps we have made in that time. And you see that Iraqis have been left way behind. A whole generation has grown up without education or adequate health care. And parents are helpless to do anything about it. The Iraqi people have really gotten it from all sides, from the United States and the United Nations via sanctions, and their own government via repression and corruption and terror. That was before the last invasion. Iraq is one big environmental catastrophe. Among other things, DU has contaminated water supplies and devastated crops. Some 500,000 tons of raw sewage is dumped into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and other freshwater sources every day. Waterborne diseases such as hepatitis A, hepatitis B, typhoid fever, typhus, and cholera have skyrocketed. The rise in cancers and preventable diseases such as influenza, dysentery, and tuberculosis has further burdened the drastically overextended healthcare system, which was once the envy of the region. Because of the precarious state of their families, most women have been staying home since the sanctions began. The illiteracy rate has crept up. The life expectancy rate has plummeted. Children were staying home from school even before the kidnappings and street fighting of the last year and a half and made it too scary to send kids out of the house. The average Iraqi child under 5 has diarrhea 14.4 days a month. So sending kids to school wasn't always a good thing, especially when schools have inadequate plumbing, no nurses, no food, and little in the way of books. When we were there, many children were spending their days in the neighborhoods, playing in the streets, where things were not much better, but at least they were close to home. And since then, there has been the added fear of kidnapping and the insurgencies against the occupation, which have been claiming thousands of lives. People are now afraid to send kids out, even into the streets in front of their houses. Hundreds of civilians, many of them children, are killed and injured every week now. The Iraqi civilian death toll is now likely in the vicinity of 100,000 since the beginning of the invasion. Not that anyone is really keeping specific count. I've spoken to many friends in Iraq who have children, and they are really just beside themselves with worry. One thing we hear little of in the press here is the mental health of the kids. Their parents report, not surprisingly, that they are always terrified. Most of them have had their homes raided at least once by U.S. soldiers, almost always in the middle of the night, and always with guns drawn. Kidnappings and bombings and missile fire are ever present in their daily lives. Many have been orphaned. Now, many of them have been imprisoned in their homes for months on end. That's pretty vicious and demoralizing and growth stunting for children, both mentally and physically. And there are no therapists or psychologists in Iraq, let alone Valium and other drugs. From one of the lowest mortality, childhood mortality rates in 1990, Iraq now has one of the highest on earth. In 1996, now note that's 9 years ago, so the numbers are much higher today, but this is the last time anyone had kept official numbers. The United Nations and other independent reporting groups estimated that 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a direct result of the sanctions. That is, as a direct result of the sanctions. That is, as a direct result of the sanctions imposed by the United States and the United Nations. And perhaps 1.2 million Iraqis in total had died. Yet when confronted with that number during an interview on 60 Minutes, President Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, had this to say: "We think the price is worth it." Iraq's economy was already in shambles thanks to sanctions before the 2003 invasion, and it hasn't improved much, at least not for Iraqis. The 250 Iraqi dinar note was worth $750 US in 1990. Just before the invasion, when we were there, it was worth a dime. We handed these money changers $50 in US and got back the stack of 250 dinar notes you see on the left. We had to carry it around in a bag. It was too much to stuff in a pocket or purse. Unemployment was moderate before the March 2003 invasion, but many people were employees of the government, all the usual civil servants, plus health care and education and transportation workers. So they at least had reliable, if small, paychecks. When Paul Bremer took over as the U.S.-appointed coalition provisional authority leader in May of 2003, his first major act was to fire a half million state workers, many soldiers, of course, but also, among others, doctors, nurses, and teachers, because remember, schools and healthcare, even such as they were under sanctions, were free and government-run. Next, Bremer got rid of all the taxes, duties, and inspections at the border, so anybody could come in with any kind of goods. The idea behind this CPA plan was to let free markets take root by privatizing all the businesses that had formerly been government-run. That's how democracy would take hold, through the capitalist system that has been so successful elsewhere. So since the invasion, most of these government workers have gone unemployed, even now, almost 2 years later. Official numbers place the unemployment rate in the 65% range still. That's pretty awful enough, but from my research, I think it's even higher, around 85%. There's probably no better recipe for disaster in a country than to have a majority of its men unemployed, especially men who frequently have a wife, children, and elderly parents or parents-in-law, and sometimes unmarried women relatives to provide for. Add to that the absolutely intolerable conditions of no electricity and little or no telecommunications, no decent schools and healthcare, no fresh water, and little food. Meantime, formerly state-owned factories sit idle. They need emergency generators because of the daily blackouts, and they need money to purchase parts and raw materials. But otherwise, they're fully capable of making the materials needed to rebuild the country, using Iraqi workers. But that's not what's happening in Iraq these days. under the U.S. occupation and the new Iraqi government. Instead, even still, the contracts for work are going to non-Iraqi countries and non-Iraqi workers, those that remain in the country anyway, with conditions as bad as they've become. Congress has appropriated billions and billions of dollars for the reconstruction of Iraq, yet Iraq's formerly state-owned factories have been completely excluded from receiving these reconstruction contracts. Instead, the billions have gone to Western companies, with most of the materials for the reconstruction imported at great expense, a sheer waste of money, and such an obvious slap in the face to the Iraqi people that it should hardly be any wonder that many of them are taking up with the insurgents. How can anyone expect people to sit quietly and wait for the free market to make non-Iraqi companies prosperous and let them then trickle that prosperity down to the workers, assuming that they would even hire Iraqis? Much of their suffering has been brought about by the policies of the United States government, but the Iraqis we met both before and after the invasion could readily differentiate between the people of this country and its government. They made no secret of the fact that they disliked the Bush administration and absolutely did not want a war. Yet they were incredibly warm and friendly and hospitable. Everywhere we went, we were invited in for a meal or a cup of tea. And these people have very, very little. Most of them have relied since 1996 on a monthly basket of sugar, flour, salt, coffee, tea, rice, and legumes from the UN Oil for Food program. But just before the invasion, they happily joined us in peace vigils, in passing the peace sign and the thumbs up sign of hope. At that time, the Iraqis were thrilled to know that Americans cared for them and were against the war. At that point, of course, the Iraqis thought, and many Americans thought, including me, that the invasion could be averted. We thought that the worldwide outcry against war, the international pressure, and the pressure from within the United States, the millions marching in the streets would make some difference and persuade the Bush administration to stay the course of diplomacy and inspections. But those naive people like me didn't know then what we know now, that the war had been planned for more than a year and that this administration was set on it no matter what. Since then, we've learned a lot more about Iraq, about its people, the U.S. invasion, and the reasons behind it. I've spent most of my time since the return from our first trip in reading about those issues and working on them. During our two visits, we interviewed hundreds of Iraqis. The one thing we can say for sure is that there's no white and black in Iraq. There are thousands, probably millions of shades of gray, millions of truths, and millions of unexploded cluster bombs and other munitions left behind. There's no easy answer to the horrific situation there now. There's no way for the United States to save face and make things better. No way to make amends. The consequences of the U.S. rush to war will be felt for many decades. In my research over the past 2 years, I've been saddened to learn of the culpability of our country in what has turned out to be a travesty of tremendous international gravity and heartbreaking implications for the people of Iraq, as well as the region and the whole world. The U.S. has made such a mess of things, and for its own troops as well. American troops there are miserable. They're being targeted daily. They went into a war they should never have been sent into in the first place. And if they were going to be sent, their leaders should never have left them so terribly unprepared, with no language or cultural training. How could they be expected to keep the peace in a place where they can't even communicate with the people? We felt the greatest sympathy for them, broiling in the 135 degree heat of the summer with no shade, no cover, wearing full combat gear, sitting on hot tanks and jeeps and fighting vehicles. And now they've been through two such summers, and another one's about to start. The next few slides are pretty horrible, too. Much has been said and written about the atrocities at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. It should be obvious to any observer of humanity that any time transparency and accountability are eliminated, such horrific abuses are absolutely inevitable. We should not have been so shocked at the revelations of torture by U.S. soldiers. Every soldier I have spoken with quietly attests to the fact that military training, by its very nature, turns the enemy into subhumans in the minds of those being trained. The problem with this, of course, is that it also inherently subsumes the humanity of the soldiers. The U.S. Congress and citizens basically shrugged at the news 2.5 years ago that people were being held completely incommunicado, without charges, in Guantanamo Bay. There was barely a blip in the media when Amnesty International, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and Mercy Corps reported in the summer of 2003, while George and I were in Iraq, that abuses and torture were going on. So we should not have been the least bit surprised at the revelations of gross torture and murder at Abu Ghraib. Government data show that at least 108 people have died in U.S. custody in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, as the AP reported just 2 days ago. About a quarter of those cases have been investigated as having been caused by U.S. abuse. The figure, which is far higher than any previously disclosed, includes cases investigated by the Army, Navy, CIA, and Department of Justice. Some 65,000 prisoners have been taken during these two wars. Most of them have been later freed. The Pentagon has never provided comprehensive information on how many prisoners have died. That figure of 108 is based on information supplied by Army, Navy, and other government officials. Is not complete. It also includes deaths attributed to natural causes. To me, and to a lot of other human rights activists or observers, the deaths form a clear pattern. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero said the other day, despite the military's own reports of death and abuses of detainees in U.S. custody, it is astonishing that our government still can pretend that what is happening is the work of a few rogue soldiers. No one at the highest levels of our government has yet been held accountable for the torture and abuse. And that is unacceptable. I completely agree with him. I think that most U.S. soldiers went into Iraq believing that they were doing the right thing, probably believing that they were liberating Iraqis. I wonder how many of them believe that now as they're hitting the 2-year anniversary today of the invasion. I wonder if they know how little news of their sacrifices and the sacrifices of their buddies in arms reaches us via the mainstream media. I wonder how they managed to get through. I've spoken to a lot of returned veterans of this invasion and occupation who feel very betrayed, and my heart really breaks for them. There will be nobody there to help them recover. Some of you were fortunate to hear the 4 veterans who spoke at Ithaca College in the fall, and to hear Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey at GIAC a little over a week ago. If so, you were probably as chilled as I was when they described how they felt when they killed people. And how they feel now, remembering that they killed unarmed women and children. These soldiers will never be the same. Right after he got out of the Marines last year, Jimmy Massey said in an interview, "The armed forces are in a tight spot over there. It's starting to leak out about the civilian casualties that are taking place. The Iraqis know. I keep hearing reports from my former Marine buddy, from my Marine buddies inside, that there were 200-something civilians killed in Fallujah. The military is scrambling right now to keep the rap on that. My understanding is Fallujah is just littered with civilian bodies." Massey also shared his stories of how he lied to young recruits to get them to sign up. He was a Marine recruiter. He says this is standard operating procedure in the military, as were the killings of innocent civilians. Anyone who has studied the Vietnam War, even casually, understands this. Jimmy Massey takes 4 antidepressants every day and 1 antipsychotic. His doctor says he will never really recover. One thing every single combat veteran I have ever spoken with agrees on: there is no such thing as a pro-war combat veteran. Iraqis are miserable and frightened and angry for all the reasons I've already pointed out and more. Lines for gasoline in this country with the 2nd largest oil reserves in the world are miles and hours long, sometimes 2 days long. People still have no or erratic electricity and still have no decent drinking water and little food. Their homes have been damaged or destroyed, and most of them have received no compensation, no help in rebuilding. There are unexploded munitions in the places where their children play. They're frightened and bored and poor and hungry. Fires burn out of control in their cities. They're worried about their families and their future. They want the basic human rights of clean water, adequate food, electricity, communication, and to be treated with dignity. Safety and security and jobs are their primary concerns, and they have been more than a year now. Saddam Hussein is gone, but they feel like he has been replaced by another, equally insidious, or perhaps even worse, dictator. They do not want their country to remain occupied. There was no terrorist activity in the country before the invasion, yet now Iraq is a greenhouse for terrorists. Nobody believes that the elections of January 29th were free and fair, and people are extremely skeptical about the chances of the new government in the next few months. We just reconnected with our very articulate U.S. educated friend, Basim, in Baghdad, after having lost touch for several months. He wrote to us this week. As for the elections, I didn't vote out of self-respect, as I'm not ready yet to accept any kind of political process based on sectarian, ethnic, or religious foundations. Me and the crushing majority of Iraqi intellectuals were alienated by such an awry process. Most Iraqi people, including the majority of those who participated, want a process with clear goals regarding the occupation. Economic policy away from incontinent capitalism, socialism, or criminal corporate domination, and absolute freedom to set our own destiny without dictations from U.S. or any other foreign body. Any measures taken now under direct sponsorship by the occupiers will face a keeling over in the future. It is already stamped as illegitimate. Whoever invests now in Iraq is siphoning. In Iraqi siphoning, will and for sure face a grim future and legal consequences. The majority of influential intellectuals in Iraq are now feeling suppressed by unsurpassed terrorism and humiliation not experienced even during the brutal Saddam era. Added to that, a full-scale theft and corruption by the occupiers and all their stooges without exception. This tired country is already drained of its fortunes, let alone the American taxpayer. I wish you can comment and see and touch the extent of terrorism and colossal corruption. You will be alerted by shootings to give way to any puny police or National Guards patrol instead of common car sirens. Let alone that, your car could be crushed or you could be killed if it's a mercenary or a U.S. Army convoy. Nobody dares to question them. Don't interpret my wish as an invitation. I'm sane enough to tell you don't come. Not because Iraqis do not welcome Americans. On the contrary, Iraqis much realize that some of you are doing the Iraqi body count, archiving looting and all future necessary data related to the atrocities done here. We need Americans like you since our esteemed sovereign government is fully occupied into masking them, terrorizing to the extent of torturing and killing anyone who dares to inquire. The problem is now it's become so difficult to distinguish between friendly people and mercenaries, or labeled civil contractors in recent terminology, who are pouring into this country by the thousands, many disguised as humanitarian activists or freelance reporters. I can't predict what the near future is like, but I'm certain of my people's courage, assertion, and obstinacy that eventually will tip over whatever comes with or is dictated by the occupation, whether it's a year, a decade, or a century. I can't predict, as it depends on the battling capabilities of the foe and its power. Basim is an angry man, and who can blame him?